And so as we study Nehemiah this morning and think about the story of Nehemiah, I think we'll see some connections then about leadership and about how what I've called his burden we can connect with too. I enjoyed this morning's manna text. Again, coincidentally, Brother Russell used the word burden in there, casting all of our cares upon him, for he careth for you. And use the word burden in the context of his comments. And we think of burden in that sense of anxious thoughts that we have and so forth quite often. But this burden that we're going to be talking about today is a different kind of a burden. It's a burden that says it's a desire of the heart that one wants to accomplish. And this burden of Nehemiah in particular was, although it was in his heart, because of the way he followed up on that, it was cultivated by God. Because the burden on his heart was for his people. And as we get into that story today, and if you haven't already done so, turn in your Bibles to Nehemiah. And we're going to follow a little bit, in particular the first chapter. We won't go verse by verse through the whole book, but in particular the first couple of chapters probably. Now, when I first began or stumbled across this study, Nehemiah was being used by another writer that I was reading on leadership as an example of what's called the law of navigation in leadership. And the law of navigation basically says that if you don't know where you're going, almost any road will take you there. So, actually, that's probably the opposite of the law of navigation. The law of navigation really gets to vision. And that is, you know where you're going. You know where you want to be. And Bible students, we have a vision, don't we? We know that blessed hope of the kingdom that thrills our hearts and made us want to dedicate our lives to a God that was that loving for all of mankind. We have that vision of the kingdom, and we saw clearly the opportunity of the call of God to be a part of that vision. And in that sense, it was a burden upon our hearts, not in the sense of being anxious or worried or concerned, but a burden in the sense that we want to do all we can to make that happen. Nehemiah's burden was clarified in his own mind when his brethren came to him from Jerusalem. And they came to where he was dwelling in this citadel of Susa. And he says, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile, also about Jerusalem. And in questioning, he found out that the walls of Jerusalem were broken down and burned. And they described that to him so graphically, I think, that it really pained his heart. How could that possibly be? The people of Jerusalem were living in shame and despair. They were the butt of jokes of the other people around. A little bit of a timeline. These dates are dates that I think are accurate. They might be a little bit different from chronologies that you're familiar with, but they're close enough. And it's not the accuracy of the dates right now that I'm concerned about as much as I am a sense of the timing. 539 B.C., you had the fall of Babylon. 458 B.C., the seventh year of Artaxerxes. And you had Ezra's decree to go back to build again the walls of Jerusalem. So 458 B.C. And then 445 B.C., the 20th year of Artaxerxes, this was 13 years later, this still had not happened. The burden of Nehemiah was there. The walls of Jerusalem were still in disrepair. And we read about that, of course, beginning in Nehemiah 1:1. And so the setting in this overcoming of these foreign armies The wall of Jerusalem had been ripped down. The gates of it had been burned for decades now. Thousands of Jews had seen the walls, and yet they had done nothing. They had continued to live in poverty and despair at the foot of those broken down walls. They needed a leader. They needed someone to give them a vision of what was possible. And so our story begins. Once again, Nehemiah's brother, it says his brethren, I think this probably was his brother in the flesh also, visits him at the palace of Shushan. Nehemiah weeps when he hears about Jerusalem state. And then we come to this leadership thought that I've alluded to earlier. Leaders not only know where they're going, they also know how to get there. And so as Nehemiah thought about, what can I do, whether intuitively because he had intuitive skills in this or whatever, he knew what he had to do in order to get this vision accomplished of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. So Nehemiah had the vision of a leader. And a leader sees farther than others see. The rest of those Jews that were living by those broken down walls couldn't see beyond those broken down walls. Neither could the Jews that were living outside, hundreds or maybe thousands of miles away. They could hear the stories, but they didn't have a vision of, let's rebuild again those walls. They see more than others can see. Nehemiah began to not only know that this would take some time further down the road, but he began to see what it would take to accomplish that. And obviously he saw before others saw. These are characteristics of great leaders. A question for you. Do you like to plan the trip? Are you content to go along for the ride, to just take it? As you think about opportunities that you have to lead, there are times when all of us have this opportunity to plan the trip. And at times there will be burdens in our lives too that God has placed upon our hearts. Not again a burden in the sense of anxious care, but of opportunity to serve God and the brethren. Do we want to get involved in that? Do we want to plan that trip? Do we want to do what we can, apply all of our skills to make that happen? Or are we going to leave it up to somebody else and go along for the ride? Another leadership thought. Leaders find purpose in the needs around them. So whatever Nehemiah's life had prepared him for to this point, when he heard this story, there was a new purpose in his life. Here he was, the cupbearer to the king. And perhaps I'm getting ahead of my story here, but again, that's the thoughts that are coming to my mind right now. Here he was, the cupbearer to the king. He was, as we say, the king's right-hand man. The cupbearer in those days not only would, just like the beef eater in English days where we'd taste the meat ahead of time, the cupbearer would make sure that this was safe drink. The king wouldn't die as a result of drinking the wine. But because he was in close confidence to the king, he was a confidant. The king would ask him questions, would say, what do you think I ought to do? He had that advisory capacity because he was so close to him. And so Nehemiah had the ear of the king, and he knew that unless something would be done, his people would indeed perish. In Proverbs, Solomon wrote, where there is no vision, the people perish. And so we read that Nehemiah's words, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned. Could have been less than a week. Could have been a week. Could have been more than a week. For some days I mourned. I fasted. And I prayed before the God of heaven. Now, what do you think he prayed? Do you think he prayed, God, help me rebuild those walls? Or did he pray, God, show me what to do? This is a burden upon my heart. These walls of your glorious city of Jerusalem are broken down. Show me what to do. What would have been the nature of his prayer? Think about that. Did he take it upon himself to say, God, this is what we must do? Or did he wait patiently on God for the answer for what to do. Nehemiah offered a prayer that had many parts. In fact, when you study the topic of prayer in the Bible, you find that typically a prayer in the model prayers in the Bible, like the Lord's Prayer, if you go back to Genesis and you take a look at Jacob's prayer when he met Esau, and just before he went out to meet him that next day and he was fearing for his life, he offered a prayer to God, and that was a model prayer. And these prayers have an aspect of adoration. Our Father, which art in heaven, our Holy Father, that aspect. And Nehemiah's prayer is no exception. Prayers have supplication, they have questions, they have imploring God, either on our behalf or on the behalf of others. A model prayer has confession. Oftentimes, I'm not worthy, O God, of all the mercies that you've showered upon me. I know I'm not worthy to be asking these things. I've sinned, and it's a confession of sins, but nevertheless, there's this burden on the heart. Oftentimes, there's thanksgiving in the prayer. Thank you for all the way you've led. And I put this in brackets because in Nehemiah's prayer, we don't see that aspect. So in one sense, it's not a model prayer necessarily because it doesn't contain all of the parts like many of the other prayers do. And so Nehemiah prayed, O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God. You see adoration there? Who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and obey his commands. Another aspect of prayer is that, at least these model prayers, is that they lay hold upon the promises of God. You who have made these promises to me, I'm laying hold of that now. You've promised that if we obey your commands, you will bless us. It says, let your ear be attentive. This is the supplication, and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's house, have committed against you. So here in very few words, adoration, laying hold upon the promises of God, supplication, confession. I'm not sure why my font changed, but I'll do my best to read it for you. We have acted very wickedly, more confession, towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, the decrees, and the laws that you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, so again, he's laying hold upon the promises of God, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. So again, he continues to lay hold upon the promises of God. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. The aspect of adoration continues throughout here. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. And then he makes a note, I was cupbearer to the king. So what did he ask for? He asked for favor when he approached King Artaxerxes. He says, God, it's almost like saying, please let him not be angry with me when I ask him this favor. No, don't let him chop my head off when I come to him. Let him hear my request. So when he says, in the presence of this man, that's what he was talking about. When I go and talk to King Artaxerxes, let him hear my request. A burden of the sort of burden that we're talking about purifies motives. We talked about that a little bit yesterday when we talked about servants. Servants have pure motives. And here, you probably noticed in his prayer, Nehemiah talked about himself as God's servant and the Israelites as the servants of God. But as himself, this burden purified his motives. It wasn't for himself that he wanted to rebuild these walls. Do you think he had a vision of, you know what, I'm going to be a great man. I'm going to go rebuild these walls and the people are going to look up to me. They'll probably elect me a governor over that. And I'll become a great man. Not like those that aspire to be presidents of the United States who probably have those grandiose kinds of ideas in their heads. The greatest of them usually are servant-oriented, though, aren't they? They have a passion to serve. And so a burden purifies motives. I want to do this for your name's sake. These walls are broken down, God. They are making fun of your people, and they are making light of you as the God, as the one and only true God. A burden cultivates persistence. Nehemiah knew that he had to follow through in some way with this. A burden cements conviction. He was convinced that he needed to do this. A burden can be a sign. Lots of worthwhile activities clamor for a leader's attention. They clamor for your attention. There's a lot of good things. They clamor for my attention day in and day out. There are so many needs in our society and worldwide. Where do you even begin to help the people? But a need's not necessarily a call. A burden helps a leader know that he must take on a task. That quote was from a man by the name of John C. Maxwell that has written many books on leadership. So do you have a burden? Does a person or a project constantly come to your mind as a concern? Do you seem unable to escape the needs of this concern? Does it weigh on you in that sense? Are you constantly trying to challenge others to be concerned for this person or this project? You know, brethren, this is something we really need to do, for example. Do you migrate to books, to sermons, or people that focus on your concern? Do you look for ways to make it happen? Do you repeatedly give time and resources to meet this particular need? Does your concern move you to the point of tears? These are all indications that it's a burden. Do you have gifts and abilities to meet the needs associated with this concern? Or do you need to acquire more skills? Does your concern increase or decrease with time? And so, in a leadership sense, if you are called to be a leader or to be an influencer among leaders, a leader of leaders or amongst leaders, what need around you stirs your heart? What can you get involved? What is it that God is directing you with this burden on your heart to get involved with? A leadership thought, a leader follows the carpenter's rule, measure twice, saw once. Don't know how many times I wish I'd have done that. For which of you intending to build a tower sitteth down, or sitteth not down first and counteth the cost, whether he hath sufficient to finish it? So that's a scriptural thought, isn't it? Nehemiah's navigation. So again, we see he identified with the problem. He spent time in prayer. He didn't just take upon this burden or take upon pursuing this without going to God first. He approached the key influencers. Dear God, let me have a successful audience with this man, this king. He assessed the situation. He knew what had to be done. He met with the people and he cast the vision. I think I'm getting a little ahead of myself at this point. So I'm going to stop there and go back. Before he got to this point where he met with the people, let's talk a little bit more about his audience with the king. You know, when he went to the king asked him, so what is it that you... Actually, before he even did that the first time, he had a downcast aura about him, didn't he? The king was basically said, what's wrong, Nehemiah? You look sad. What's going on here? So what did Nehemiah do? He prayed. He wanted the right words to share with the king. And so when those words came to him, he told the king, you know, the walls of the city of my people are broken down. And the king basically said, well, what is it you want to do? And Nehemiah, in so many words, said, I want to go back. I want to rebuild those walls. And the king said, how long is it going to take you? I don't think that, if I remember right, he didn't really give him an answer. He didn't quite know how long it was going to take. He was concerned about safe passage there. It wasn't safe to just travel from the palace there across probably what is now Iraq and all the way to Jerusalem and rebuild that city. There would have been enemies all along the way, enemies against Israel, because it was governed in a different way. Yeah, Artaxerxes was the king of that territory, but there were governors that had authority over different provinces. And Artaxerxes let them have pretty much free reign over their territory. And so here, if he's going to be cutting across there, he's not necessarily going to be safe. So he gets a letter from the king that says, you got safe passage. Allow this man to travel to Jerusalem. And not only so, he gave him an armed guard, didn't he? So he had soldiers going along with him. And Nehemiah, you can imagine the trepidation in his heart. Not only was he asking for permission for a leave of absence from his job to go accomplish with this, probably without a strict timeline, how long are you going to be gone, but he's also now given resources, and he asked for more resources. You know what? I need some trees. I need some artisans. I need a lot of resources in order to make this happen. And the king granted all of those things to him. But once he got there to Jerusalem, the first thing that he did was to assess the situation. I think I might have had that in the previous slide. So to that point, he had approached the key influencers. But once he got to Jerusalem, he assessed the situation. You remember what he did? He got up in the wee hours of the morning, still dark. He got on a donkey, and he rode around the city. How big was this job going to be? So he rode around it, and he assessed the situation. In private, didn't have a lot of other people with him. How big is this job going to be? And then he began to meet with the people, because probably what's the first indication that you have that a man is a leader? He's got followers, right? If he doesn't have any followers, he's not a leader. He had to share that vision with them, and they had to identify with that vision. The power of a vision can't be underestimated. We've seen it, most of us have seen it in our own lifetime in the United States. The most powerful example that I keep coming across is John F. Kennedy. And the world was, the United States in particular, was chagrined. It was like the walls were broken down when the Russians put an astronaut out there in space. And do you think they began to fear the United States? Sure they did. The idea of these bomb shelters that everybody was talking about began to be more real. But John F. Kennedy said, you know what we're going to do? Before this decade is out. So this was around 1960 he was saying this. Within the next 10 years, before 1970 gets here, we're going to put a man on the moon. We're not just going to put him in space and take him around the earth. We're going to put a man on the moon. We're going to bring him back to earth safely. So there was some quality assurance there. And we're going to do this. And the people rallied around that vision. Now, the vision was bigger than that. The vision really was that the United States is going to be the most technologically advanced nation in the world, bar none, and the world's going to look up to us as the most technologically advanced nation. And the proof of that is we're going to put a man on the moon and we're going to bring him back. That's the power of vision, and it happened. People started rallying around, industry rallied around, people started doing everything that had to happen to improve the economy. It's one of the most powerful examples of vision that most of us will ever personally experience. But Nehemiah was not unlike that. So he met with the people and he cast the vision for them. He encouraged them with past successes. He said, you know, God has fought for us before. Yes, he's permitted this phase of our history. But he's given us promises that if we return to him, he will make this happen. So he encouraged them with that. He received buy-in from the people. They thought, yeah, we can do this. He organized the people and he got them working. And he did it in very logical ways. To get buy-in, He said, well, you know, your family lives right here by this section of the wall. Now, it'd probably be a pretty good idea if you built that section of the wall for your family's protection. And I imagine there's enough buy-in to say, we're going to build a sturdy section of wall here because we live here. And then the next family, by them, and then the next family. So he organized them by those logical family structures, and they began the work of building the wall. And so another question for as a leader, do you make a plan before you move? Leaders not only know where they're going, they also take people with them. Nehemiah 4, 6 and 10 through 11. So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. I bet they did. And then Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing, and there's so much rubbish that we're not able to build the wall. And our adversaries said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So there was something else going on about this time too. You know, at first the adversaries teased them, laughed at them. You're going to rebuild these walls? What a joke. But then they saw it happening. So now they're saying, maybe we better do something to make sure it doesn't happen. We'll sneak in by midnight, we'll tear the walls down before they ever get a chance to keep going. We'll kill them, we'll cause the work to cease. Now there was a governor over that area, and he had no interest in seeing these walls rebuilt, because the Jews would begin to get more power and authority. So even though Nehemiah had permission from the king, the governor had different ideas. Therefore, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, Nehemiah said. And I set the people according to their families, with their swords, their spears, and their bows. So now then, not only were they building, they had to arm themselves and they had to protect that section of the wall at the same time some were building. Those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other they held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. So there was ready to be sounded this trumpet so that if there was a breach of the wall in one part of the city, or if they were attacked on one part of the city, the others would quickly go there and help to defend it. So Nehemiah had some people principles that he followed in this. One, he simplified things. Didn't make it complicated. You build this section of the wall, carry your armaments with you. He got everybody involved, participation. Some of you don't get to sit back. Delegation by those that were motivated to do the job. Motivation and self-motivation is a big part of delegation. You make sure that the job gets done because the motivated parties assign the work. Again, motivation we've addressed. Preparation. We talked about that as far as beginning to even, he assessed the situation before he ever began. Cooperation, work together here. And celebration. So I've gotten a little ahead of myself here. The wall was finished. How long did it take them? Remember? 52 days, something. I think it was 52 days, yeah. And can you imagine? Less than two months to totally rebuild this wall that had been torn down for decades. Now, I think when Nehemiah went there, I don't remember, it took him several months, and he got there in the spring, and I think it was another year later that they actually probably built the wall, because remember, they had to get timbers from in the northern part of, you know, the Cedars of Lebanon, so to speak. They had to get all of the equipment and or materials and the artisans had to build things. All of these things had to get prepared. So I think it was probably more than a year later that the wall was actually built. But from the time they picked up a trowel and started laying bricks and mortar, it was less than 2 months that wall was built. And so what does a leader do when it's all done? He celebrates. He causes a celebration. Look what we've done. And he shares the joy. Not look what I've done. Look what we've done. And praise God. And so leaders, as leaders, we need to ask ourselves, who are we gathering for our leadership journey? No great task is accomplished without both people to do the work and a leader to guide them. Again, one of the thoughts from John Maxwell. Some key leadership thoughts in our discussion today. Leaders know, not only know where they're going, they also know how to get there. Leaders find purpose in the needs around them. That's where the burden comes from. A leader follows the carpenter's rule, measure twice, saw once, sit down, count the cost, make sure you have sufficient to finish the job. Leaders not only know where they're going, they take people with them. Some key servant thoughts. True leaders serve. It's not just their burden, it's for others that they're doing this work. God's purpose for us is often revealed to us through the burdens that we feel. And so we go back to God and say, and in prayer, we ask Him, is this what you want me to do? There's that communication with God that needs to be there. God's servants seek His will through prayer, and they patiently wait for guidance, just like Nehemiah did before he went to the king, before he proceeded from there. God's servants courageously act on the opportunities He provides with focus, patience, and persistence. Once the burden's revealed to us, once we have the assurance of God that that's what He wants us to do, we step out in faith to accomplish it. Before we close with a prayer that would reflect Nehemiah's burden, the rest of the story of Nehemiah was very interesting too. Do you remember how long he was gone? He ended up being gone about 12 years. 12 years before he went back. And then he found out that all of the work that he did in terms of cleansing the sanctuary, because that's what he had done. He not only rebuilt the walls, he said, get out the book of the law. Let's look at it. Let's find out what we're supposed to do. And so we're supposed to have the priests doing this. The temple sanctuary needs to be cleansed. You get out all of these pagan idols. You get out. It had been made into a storehouse. Clean it out. But then he comes back for a visit and he finds out that all of that work had been undone. The governor had wormed his way back in there and was corrupting the sacrifices and the worship again. I think there was one of the Jewish women had even married the governor's nephew or something like that. And so now the intermarriage was starting to corrupt the governance of everything. Things were starting to fall apart. So he had to go back. He had to cleanse it all out again and to lay down the law, so to speak, to say, keep this pure. So Israel themselves had to continually be brought back. They continually needed leaders to bring them back to the true worship of God. So we might pray this prayer as we reflect on Nehemiah's story. God, reveal Your purpose in our lives. What burden would You have us bear? Connect us with the burden that You've placed in our hearts. Help us to be obedient to Your calling. Give us the ability to fulfill Your vision. Thy will, not ours, be done. And so it is that with those thoughts in mind, we want to have our hearts in tune with God's will, so that the burden that we feel to accomplish His will is indeed His will. It's not our own grandiose plans, but that we are merely servants of His to go forward. And our job is to, in a metaphoric sense, build up the walls of Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem that will come down from God out of heaven, to exhort, to edify, to build up our brethren who will be of that church class to live and reign with Christ for 1,000 years for the blessing of all the families of the earth. And may God help us to be faithful to that end.